This nation was founded on the principle that all men are created equal.
We hold these truths to be self-evident.
That all men are created equal.
I'll tell you what freedom is to me. No fear. I mean, really, no fear.
Isn't it equal?
From WDET in Detroit, this is Created Equal. I am Kerry Jr. II, filling in for Stephen Henderson. Good morning. Earlier in the top of the hour during the billboard, we were discussing Vice President Kamala Harris and her position currently now as a potential nominee for the Democratic Party for president. I want to go through a couple other details here. There's an Associated Press survey that found that Harris had secured support from enough Democratic delegates to become her party's nominee. It's important to keep in mind, though, that the pledged delegates are non-binding. So when the convention eventually rolls around in August, those delegates could go to anyone, but she has secured an overwhelming majority of those delegates. And then we haven't seen a major or serious challenger to Harris either. So now the focus is on her and the kind of candidate she would be if she were to face former President Trump. So to have that conversation today, I am joined by Elena Plott Calabro. She is a political journalist and staff writer at The Atlantic. She's the author of several pieces about Kamala Harris in The Atlantic, including an excellent profile called The Kamala Harris Problem. Elena, thank you for joining me. Good morning.
Hi, Kerry. Good morning. It's great to be here.
Awesome. So let's kind of get this started off. You followed Kamala Harris for some years, and you've written about her for some years. Tell us a little bit about her temperament, who she is as a person, what you kind of got a feel of from her by following her in her day-to-day life.
Well, it's a great question, but it's a complicated answer, in large part because Kamala Harris is a pretty guarded politician. Mm-hmm. And I think that makes a lot of sense when you think about where she started her career. She didn't start as sort of a stump speech politician. She was a prosecutor first in Alameda County, and then the district attorney in San Francisco, then attorney general in California. So if you think about your own district attorney, it's not the sort of person that you're looking to for warm and fuzzy, soaring speeches about democracy or anything like that. It's very black and white. It's very data driven. That's what politics was for her. And so now that she's been on the national stage, I think a huge transition for her has been into sort of those gauzier elements that we expect as voters from our national leaders. Mm-hmm. So as I spent a lot of time with her on the campaign trail, it took a great deal of time before I felt I was able to get kind of past the surface with her. Finally, in our third interview, we sat down in the vice president's residence. And once she was in her own territory, you really saw her finally let her guard down a bit. Mm. And I found her to be almost maternal, Kerry. I mean, at one point, she looks at me and she says, "So you're newly married." And it wasn't a question. And I had not told her this, but I just said, "Yes, Madam Vice President, I am." And she said, "Pay attention to your marriage, your relationships, because life has a way of sweeping you up." And I just thought it was a really powerful moment that you don't experience often, as I'm sure you know, as a journalist mm-hmm. with a politician. But I guess I just want to emphasize it really took time to get there with her. And so when I hear voters, report on the trail and they say to me, "She just doesn't seem authentic. I don't really know what she's about." That is something she's had to overcome and try to give voters more of that instant sense of connection in a way that somebody like, say, Bill Clinton or Barack Obama were able to.
I'm always reminded by the saying that you want to sit down and have a beer with your potential leader, whether a governor or a president. And it seems like that's always kind of been our barrier with Vice President Harris. Did she say anything? Did you ask her, I guess, about that and why it is she may appear to be guarded in that way? Is it purely her profession, or is there something else that she knows she's trying to make sure she's fitting into this role and doing her job the way she needs to do it?
So one thing she said to me, which I thought was interesting, was my career has not been about giving lovely speeches. Mm. It's been about doing the work.
Execution.
Exactly. And so, but where I think that gets, complicated is that a lot of the ball game as a national politician is a lovely speech. And even if you are doing the work, however excellently behind the scenes, if you can't necessarily communicate that in a compelling way to a broad swath of Americans, it almost doesn't matter as much. You need Americans to hear what you're doing. But so much of her career has been behind the scenes. I mean, I remember talking to one of her communications directors from her time as district attorney of San Francisco. And she said, even then, you know, Kamala Harris would win a tremendous case, that she had just really done a beautiful job. Mm-hmm. And she would say, let's get this in the press. Let's get you out there and talk mm-hmm. about this. And she'd say, you know, I can't. I'm on the next case. I'm busy. And so that does matter a little bit less in those offices where the people are closer to you and it's just more easy to see day to day what you're accomplishing. Mm-hmm. When you're as far away from the average voter as the White House, that things like communication and rhetoric do become a lot more important. Mm-hmm.
Now, is there anything in the work specifically that you think informs her ability to be a candidate for president in terms of her prosecutor or attorney general past?
Absolutely. I think that especially coming up on a debate stage is where I think Americans will really mm-hmm. see Kamala Harris in her element. If you recall, the thing that really launched her into the national consciousness, I would say, was her questioning of Donald Trump nominees to the Supreme Court, like Brett Kavanaugh, cabinet picks like Jeff Sessions. That was a moment when this was a brand new junior senator from California, and a lot of Americans said, I want to know more about this person. When she can take control of a conversation, as I've seen time and again at events, she's a very, very compelling politician. And I think especially in this truncated period of time when the campaign is going to be less about her and more about what can she convince Americans of her opponent,
right,
that I think is just, you know, a really useful environment for her to be in.
She's going to prosecute the case against Donald Trump, right?
Exactly. And I was talking to one of her former comms directors the other day, and they said the bumper stickers write themselves, vote for the prosecutor, not the felon. And she, my understanding, she really plans to lean into that message for these next 3 months.
Yeah. And so is there any element that you believe, like, will she adopt the personability element for this? Do you think she'll just kind of say, like you said, this is a short period of time. I know what my sweet spot is. It's to get really specific and to go at the facts, not flower it up with kind of being this really approachable person. Will she maybe try and balance that out? Do you have a feeling for that?
You know, what's so interesting about that question is that, you know, I watched her campaign announcement speech on Monday from the headquarters in Wilmington, Delaware. Mm-hmm. And I tweeted this at the time, but I was struck by how of the dozens and dozens of Kamala Harris political speeches I have watched over the years, mm-hmm. I have never seen her more confident. And mm-hmm. here's why. I think that 4 years sort of at the height of defund the police rhetoric, the post-George Floyd moment, we are back in an America where a lot of voters are moving to the right again on crime, on these ideas of law and order. And for her, I think that it just matches with her career in a way that's always just felt more natural for her. And it's the reason I think her 2020 primary campaign flamed out before the first vote. She really had no idea how to sell her prosecutorial background in a way that felt appropriate to a Democratic base that just was not looking for that at the moment. But it's almost like the moment has come back around to meet her, I think, and her strengths. And I think she's just settling into not even a version of herself, but just really herself in a way that I certainly haven't seen on the trail before. She finally has an advisor saying to her, go be yourself. Your background is what people want right now, particularly with an opponent like Donald Trump, who is, again, a convicted felon. I mean, it's just the moment seems tailor-made for her skill set in a way that it hasn't been really for a lot of the past 4 years. And so I think that approachability will just naturally come when she is just acting more comfortable in her own skin and in her own instincts, if that makes sense.
I've seen the memes and social media posts about like this brat summer. Is that a way for them to kind of warm up the personability element of Vice President Harris and make her more approachable and allow her to kind of be more comfortable in this space now?
Well, it speaks to, I think, the connection she has with young voters in particular. Mm-hmm. So one thing as a journalist that I really, and I know is to the exasperation of her team, but that I've come to discover is mainstream media attention to her is very, very sporadic. And it's made for, I think, really disjointed narratives. So one moment, you know, you'll have one piece about how great she did at said event. But then nobody goes to her events afterwards. Sometimes I'm the only one on the plane for some of these things. Okay. And so then you have what happens like after Joe Biden's, you know, poor debate performance. So many Americans thought, oh, wow, her response on, you know, cable news after was incredible. And you had John King at CNN saying, where's this person been? Why have they been hiding her? Well, they haven't been hiding her. You know, there are just not a lot of reporters actually paying attention to her day to day. But those who have know that for the past year, she has been barnstorming the campaign trail, particularly on college campuses. And young voters, as I've seen firsthand, whether at Georgia Tech or the University of Nevada in Reno, they love her. They really, really resonate with her. And she just connects with them quite well. And so it wasn't at all a surprise to me that they were immediately, just, you know, within hours, able to incorporate a Charlie XCX endorsement into sort of the tenor of their campaign.
I see. And so she isn't really reinventing herself, right? She's leaning into who she is. What is your sense of whether she's identified that for herself and is able to kind of be who she is on the national stage? Because earlier you were talking about her kind of hesitancy, right? Her ability to kind of create a wall and do the accurate and correct thing. How much do you feel like she's actually able to identify who she would be on the national stage?
I think that her path to, again, really settling into herself really began in 2022. So up until that point in her vice presidency, she, and I put a lot of this on President Biden, actually, who I don't feel adequately invested the time in her presentation to the American people and in trying to set her up for success as vice president. And so the first year and a half to 2 years of her vice presidency, she really didn't have a focused vision for the role that she was to play. But then the Dobbs decision leaks, and suddenly Kamala Harris realizes quite acutely that this is her moment, so to speak. This is a vacuum that she can fill for the administration, because Joe Biden, as a devout Catholic, is not comfortable talking about abortion on the campaign trail. So she really spearheads what eventually becomes the administration's response to Dobbs. And what I found fascinating covering her at that time was that you really saw her confidence in herself sort of skyrocket in real time. I remember there was a moment in advance of the 2022 midterms when her advisors came to her, and they weren't challenging her. They were just saying, for your awareness, Madam Vice President, here's, you know, the latest polling that says Americans are caring about the economy going into midterms. This red wave is expected. Mm-hmm. And she said, okay, thank you, I understand that. But I'm on the campaign trail every day, a different state every day, essentially. And I'm hearing from not just Republican, Democratic women, but men as well, that reproductive rights is what they care about right now, that this is what they're going to be voting based on. And in the end, she was right. I think she understood the salience of that issue in a way very few other officials in Washington did at the time. And I think the fact that her instincts were really borne out in the fact that Democrats did do so well in midterms, that was a huge moment, I think, for her to say, okay, I got here for a reason. Mm-hmm. I should trust myself. And to me, her announcement speech and just how assured and confident she seemed and how she carried herself, I thought was the culmination of something really a year and a half, 2 years in the making.
Wow. Okay. Well, we have to take a quick break. Thank you so much, Elaine Plot Calabro. We'll be right back with you. Y'all are listening to Created Equal. This is Kerry Jr. II filling in for Stephen Henderson. We will be right back. This is 101.9 WDET in Detroit. I am Kerry Jr. II, and you're listening to Created Equal. I am joined with Elaine Plot Calabro talking about Vice President Kamala Harris and her potential bid for the presidency. We know that she has secured pledges for delegates in the Democratic Party, non-binding, as I said before. So she is the, I guess, front runner, I should say, for the potential nomination for president on the Democratic side. And so I've been talking with Calabro about her history and her background and how much that prepares her for this current race. So, Elena, I want to get into Vice President Harris's specific vice presidency and kind of how that started. It kind of got off to a rocky start, right? There were staff turnovers. There was low morale, ineffective liaison for the White House on Capitol Hill were all reported things. Can you talk a little about like what was happening in that situation and how Harris responded to that?
Sure. So you're absolutely right. It was quite a rocky start, to put it mildly. And I think it's important to start with before she and Joe Biden had even settled into the White House. As I reported last fall in my longer piece on Harris, there was really never a sit-down moment where she and Joe Biden said, "What do I want this vice? What do we want this vice presidency to look like?" And that, to me, was a really kind of astonishing decision, especially when you had a president like Joe Biden who professed to want to be a bridge to the next generation, to kind of want to return the country to normalcy, so to speak, but then pass the baton. And so the way he had always sort of presented Kamala Harris as his running mate was, "I'm basically getting the country ready for you, or a Democrat like you of your generation, to move the party forward." And so the fact that going into the presidency itself, there wasn't a great deal of investment in how to set Kamala Harris up for that moment, I think it was just sort of a bad omen from the outset. And so let's talk about her portfolio as she got in. There was staff turnover, as you said, but I think the most troubling thing that portended for maybe an unsuccessful vice presidency from the outset was the fact that Joe Biden gave her what's called the root causes element of the administration's immigration agenda. That is, you know, sort of working with the structural challenges in Central America that cause a lot of migrants to flee north to begin with. So poverty, violence, what have you. That is a really, really hard issue. I mean, to the extent that anyone can succeed in that role, we wouldn't really know, you know, a decade from now whether they had.
Yeah, it takes a while for that.
So it's not an easy win. It's not the sort of immediate way for Kamala Harris to say to the American people, "I'm succeeding on your behalf. I'm doing the work for you." And so the fact that President Biden wanted to give that to her as her entree, essentially, to the American people, it was just inevitable that that was not going to go well. And I think it all sort of culminated in that infamous Lester Holt interview, where she, you know, just couldn't get her answer straight as to whether she had been to the border. And from that moment, she really receded from public view. And I think that's a really important thing to remember about that first year. The reason that people bring up that Lester Holt interview so much is it was essentially a lot of Americans' introduction to her as vice president. It was really the first major interview that she'd done since taking office. And rather than sort of flood the zone afterward and, you know, get to a place where Americans kind of forgot that it had even happened, she got very, very anxious and risk averse after that and just sort of withdrew from public view. And that contributed, I think, to that first year and a half where you had an impression of a vice president who just didn't seem up for the job.
I see. And was that fair criticism, given how difficult and complex that issue is?
I think it was fair criticism in the sense that she wasn't giving Americans a lot else to work with. Like I said, even if you're doing great things behind the scenes, if Americans don't know about it, if it's not incumbent on you or, frankly, President Biden to make sure that Americans know about it, there's really no other way they can judge a candidate.
And so, as you mentioned, that Lester Holt video where she says, you know, "We've been to the border," and or "I haven't been to Europe," I think it was what she said. How much of that stepping back was her personal choice of saying, "I need to step back, reset"? And how much of that was the administration saying, "Wait, we don't want to put you out there yet until we've got this all kind of in alignment"?
So interestingly, it was almost entirely her choice. Like I said, part of her being a very guarded person is she is very risk averse. She's lawyerly in that way, in a sense. But you actually had Joe Biden's chief of staff at the time, Ron Klain, who was a huge advocate of hers, say, "Get back out there. You know, you messed up. Who cares? We all mess up. You know, you've got to get back out on the plate and just keep swinging until you hit one out of the park." And that that's just not necessarily how her brain is wired. And I remember he said to me in our interview that her response was, I'm just terrified of doing something that sets back this administration or distracts from the mission. She really took seriously her mandate as vice president to sort of support the president and make sure that people saw him as a really accomplished individual, as an agenda that was working for them. She was comfortable in that role, sort of working more behind the scenes, which is why I think I levy a lot of responsibility on Joe Biden for kind of freeing her from those inherent inhibitions, structural inhibitions of the vice presidency, to let her be more of a star in her own right.
Wow. Okay. That's such an interesting approach for her, because it makes sense as any person that you don't want to get into a situation where you're feeling like you're not as prepared as you ought to be. Right. You want to step back, reset, and make sure your mind is all right. And now it seems that given the current circumstances, President Joe Biden withdrawing from that race, it almost thrusts her back into that place. And you would have hoped that a candidate would have had time to kind of get more comfortable and get their footing and be able to step out there. Now, as you spoke to in the first segment, you feel like this particular time frame will work for her. But I'm wondering, like you said before, 2022 is one of those markers. What were some other points in her career as vice president where you feel like she was gaining that footing, finding herself in a way where she felt like, okay, now I can step back out there after being reclusive for a period of time?
International diplomacy, absolutely. I think another key moment for her was 2022, I believe it was. She was tapped to represent the United States at the Munich Security Conference. And she was really the person speaking on America's behalf at sort of the cusp of Russia's invasion of Ukraine. So she is the one interfacing with Zelensky, who, when she saw him at that time, she thought it was the last time she would ever see him, but essentially laying out the intelligence to him, saying, this is going to happen and you need to be prepared. And we forget at this point, but Zelensky was not, maybe it's slightly in denial, but not entirely convinced that the invasion would actually happen. And Kamala Harris was really the one who sat down with him and said, you need to take this seriously. And so that, I think, for her, when she was able to see how international leaders responded to her, which is with a great deal of respect. Emmanuel Macron is another who takes her very, very seriously. They formed a deep friendship. But when she's able to see how these other world leaders are sitting down with her and, you know, really working with her as a peer, I just think inevitably would grow anyone's confidence. But that's a role that she's played, I think, to a great deal of accomplishment in the past 2 years. But it's also something that you rarely hear about in the media. I traveled to Africa with her actually last summer. Mm-hmm. And I remember talking to a Democratic pollster as I got home. And I said, you know, this was a really fascinating trip against the backdrop of China and China sort of encroaching on Africa, able to buy up the debt of a lot of these countries. What is the future of communism in Africa? And Kamala Harris going to sort of say, we are going to try to start putting the marker down for democracy and reminding Africa that the free world is really their best partner in their future. It was a really impressive trip. And I got home and I called a Democratic pollster and they said, you know, it's interesting, as I followed that trip from afar, I thought, this is really a pivot for her in terms of her self-presentation. And I said, okay, but is that translating to voters when you're in focus groups? He says, nobody has any idea she went. Nobody knows anything about it. Yeah. So those are the sorts of things that, I mean, just inherently foreign policy doesn't break through really to American voters.
I was going to say that felt like a strange place for her to find her footing too, for her to be outside of the country in other places, being able to have these meetings and feeling like, okay, now I can really take hold and take this job on. It sounds also like part of it is the work itself is what really motivates her. Did she do any, I know you said she was having meetings and all that kind of stuff. She had public addresses. Was that what I understood too? She did public addresses when she was doing international diplomacy as well?
Absolutely. Okay. I mean, those are things that you can go online and look up. I mean, again, the Munich Security Conference, just, you know, hugely these hugely important moments that I think a lot of Americans, unless you knew to be looking for it, you just wouldn't really right. have known about it.
You would not have known about it. Oh, that's interesting. And then now we're in the campaign trail, and she has to, I think she's going to be speaking with Benjamin Netanyahu today, which is a pretty tough way to start off your campaign, given, but it sounds also like might be perfect for her, given her situation and her ability to handle herself on an international stage.
I think she is somebody that Americans should have a great deal of trust and confidence in when it comes to bilats and other meetings behind closed doors with foreign leaders. I remember learning in the reporting of my profile that there were Caribbean leaders who had come to call her sister vice president just because of how direct she was, which is to say the first time they sat down with her, the response was, oh, this person doesn't play around. There is no talk, small talk, no pleasantries. I mean, this person is business. Down to business yeah. immediately. There are no diplomatic niceties here.
That's going to be a nice, an interesting, I guess, battle, I should say, between the considered businessman debate, get the job done persona that former President Trump usually uses for himself versus Kamala Harris, who does seem very competent at her work and at her job. We're just trying to get a better idea of who she is as a person. So I was wondering, too, during this, we were talking about the international diplomacy and we were talking about her ability to have these meetings, but it not translating to voters herself. It feels like that's going to be maybe one of the key things we need to look forward to, not look forward to, but look at during this election. How much are voters going to understand who she is and how she is able to, I guess, motivate folks to come out and support her if we only know her competency behind closed doors and on the international stage?
This is something I think about so often. And, you know, it's not even just about can Kamala Harris communicate her vice presidential agenda in a way that resonates with people. It's can her surrogates. So two nights ago, Senator Chris Coons of Delaware, who was on that Africa trip at one point, is going to be, a co-chair of sorts for her campaign, as he was for the Biden campaign. He's on Fox News and is asked by Brett Baier, can you tell us about her accomplishments as vice president? And Carrie, his answer, I mean, was just sort of nonsensical. And I mean, just a lot of platitudes, but nothing really that a viewer could actually grab onto and say, oh, she did this. She did X, she did Y, she did Z. So it's not even just about can Kamala Harris get up on the stump and tell her story in a concrete and compelling way. Can the people around her do that for her as well?
There was a part in your article, too, where she talks about how Joe Biden, like what Joe Biden needs her for. I can't remember how it was worded specifically. It was about how Joe Biden would describe her value to the office. And the answer kind of felt very much businesslike. And there's like a lot of words that they use to describe their relationship and all that. But it didn't really give me a clear window into kind of who she was and how their relationship blossomed. It felt kind of generic to me. You know what I'm referencing?
Yeah. Imagine how it felt as the reporter getting that statement back.
Not it's colorful like, enough.
This is what you've been working on for 3 weeks. And to that point, I don't know if you remember, but at the end of that piece, I think such a telling moment was when I was able to get on the phone with Biden's chief of staff, Jeff Zients. And again, this is the sort of call that you arrange for in advance. You don't just cold call the chief of staff and immediately get 30 minutes for an interview. Right. So I just say that to say he has people around him who are prepping him for a call like this. You know, this is Elena Plott at The Atlantic. She wants to know about Kamala Harris and how she works with the president. It is something that you have time to sit down and think about, how am I going to address this? But when I asked him what is a pretty basic question, can you tell me about a time that President Biden has noticeably leaned on Kamala Harris for guidance? His response was, well, she was really great in reminding us to put equity at the forefront of our COVID response. And I said, okay, great. That was at the very beginning of the administration. We're now 2 years in. Can you tell me anything else? And he said, essentially, well, there's so many things. I would need to get back to you. I'd need to just think of one and get back to you. I'll have my spokesperson get back to you with an anecdote. And after that call, I followed up and I never got that anecdote. But again, it crystallized. If I had had any doubt before, it crystallized to me how the West Wing was just not putting in even what felt like a cursory amount of energy to presenting her as somebody, as an essential governing partner to Joe Biden.
I see. What about her electability compared to former President Trump? As a candidate in the eyes of independent and undecided voters, talk about that.
Well, listen, I mean, there's no sugarcoating the fact that she has historically low approval ratings as vice president. You know, the lowest recorded in NBC's poll in the history they've been doing it. So that is baggage that she carries, which is why her ability and the ability of those around her to tell the story of her vice presidency in a way that feels different from what the public has come to see of it is just so crucial. But here's what I think people can't forget. And it sounds just so basic, but it really is, I think, so crucial. Mm-hmm. The fact that, unlike Joe Biden, the past several months of this campaign, voters are going to immediately see Kamala Harris, and they're going to see her constantly. You know, she's barnstormed the country well before now in campaign-like mode. And now people are actually going to be paying attention. So we've suddenly shifted from a candidate in Joe Biden who, you know, getting an Oval Office address just seems like a huge deal because it is so rare, to somebody who is going to be at rallies day in and day out, talking to voters at photo lines day in and day out. It's just, you already have sort of this expression of energy and vitality that I think a lot of voters have been craving, whether they're Democrats or Republicans disaffected by Trump. And that in itself, I think, is going to really prime a lot of Americans, if it makes sense, to want to like her, to want to have a new understanding of her vice presidency, because I think it is, and you're already seeing that, there's just so much enthusiasm that there's now a Democratic candidate who, you know, can make phone calls for 10 hours a day and, you know, just be on the trail day in and day out. And there's no talk of an 8 p.m. bedtime.
Mm-hmm. And also now she gets to kind of redefine who she is to the American public now, right? We've had so much information about her as a potential candidate for president 4 or 5 years ago, as a vice president. And now as a presidential candidate, we get to see a little bit more of what she's going to bring to the table in that realm, which I think will be interesting to know. I mean, to your point earlier, you were talking about people being inspired about like a new face and being able to want to know who she was. There are some recent polls that are showing she's already making up some ground on Biden, in the head-to-heads versus Trump. So and that might also be the recency of the news breaking and that Biden's dropping out, and that there was already some public sentiment that wanted to see a newer, fresher face. But I do think it does speak to what you're saying here, right? The fact that folks are like, hey, there's a new person on the stage, and we're excited to see how this will play out.
Absolutely.
All right, so we're going to go to break really quickly and be right back. Coming up, I want to talk about an issue that has emerged in Harris's wheelhouse. I'll continue my conversation with Elena Plott Calabro after this. You're listening to Created Equal. I'm Carrie Jr. II, filling in for Stephen Henderson. WDET from Detroit. I'm Carrie Jr. II, and I am joined by Elena Plott Calabro. We're talking about Vice President Harris's bid for presidency, considering she's already got a head start, in the nomination process. So, Elena, I want to kind of talk about an issue that Vice President Harris has made pretty central, and she's been a stronger voice in this than President Biden has been. That's reproductive rights. She became a leading voice on abortion post-Dobbs. Can you talk about how that is kind of giving her momentum in this election now and how that might play out over the next few months?
Sure. So, like I mentioned earlier in the show, She, I think, really, especially when the Dobbs decision leaked, recognized the salience of this issue to voters in a way that a lot of her peers in Washington didn't. That was a moment when everybody, you know, the chattering class, lawmakers alike, seemed set on the idea that the economy would dictate how Republicans decided at the ballot box that November. Mm-hmm. She got on the trail, however, and did roundtables in various states, Texas, you know, red states, blue states alike, with voters of, you know, all across the political spectrum, hearing from them firsthand how abortion was important to them. And, you know, abortion had come to be just a primary motivator in what they wanted to do at the ballot box. And I think she remains pretty convinced that truth holds steady with this election, that especially with Donald Trump picking a running mate like J.D. Vance, that this issue is not going away. It was not at all a surprise to me that in her announcement speech, she mentioned the fight specifically for reproductive rights. And I think we're going to see in these next 3 months, several moments when she dedicates her events, her travels specifically to speaking on this issue. And again, I think this was the issue that allowed her to sort of regain faith in her own political mm-hmm. instincts. Mm-hmm. So I think as she continues to build on that, Americans are just going to continue to get a picture of Kamala Harris that seems radically different from the impression they had on her based on her first year and a half in office.
It sounds like these one-on-one dialogues and these conversations, especially on issues that are particularly salient for her and ones that are really important in this election, are helping us, at least helping me at least understand where Kamala Harris will be comfortable, where we'll find her strong suits. As we get into, there will be a second debate here against Trump. We still have to figure out who will be her vice presidential pick, but they will face, of course, Vance. And as you said before, Vance's stances are very different from Kamala's stances on reproductive rights. I'm wondering if not, like you spoke to before, this might be her time. There's that issue, as you said before. There is the idea that people are getting this sensibility around policing that's kind of changed from what it was last presidential cycle, that might kind of really be if there was a time, right, for her to feel as strong of a candidate as she has been before, this might be one of those moments.
So I kid you not, just 30 seconds ago, The Atlantic published my latest piece about Kamala Harris, and it is essentially this. So I'm wondering if you've read my Google Doc in advance.
Oh, wow.
you know, one of her former communications directors said to me in my reporting of this piece in the past few days, Kamala Harris is an object lesson in timing, you know, you can have all the right credentials, but if the political environment is not conducive to the message you're selling, you are just not going to break through. And we see the cyclical nature and the fickle nature, really, of politics in the fact that 4 years later, really, suddenly Kamala Harris's brand is precisely what Americans seem to be looking for. Mm. And let's go back again to that 2020 campaign. She had advisors around her at the time who said, you do not need to play up your law enforcement experience, or we need to find a way to try to reframe it. And that to her was really exasperating. She said, but this is who I am. I'm very proud of the fact that I was a prosecutor, of my record as an attorney general. What else am I supposed to talk about? And again, I think that's where the genesis of this narrative of her as sort of inauthentic, uncomfortable with herself came about. I remember David Axelrod, the Obama senior strategist, saying to me, you know, voters can tell when you're not comfortable in your own skin. And Kamala Harris certainly wasn't in the 2020 campaign trail. It almost seemed like she sort of withdrew into a caricature of 2020 progressivism. You know, on stage, she would just sort of suddenly, as if, you know, just like a deer in headlights, be like, oh, well, I'm for abolishing private health insurance. And, you know, in the fallout, people would say, wait, did you really mean that? Right. I mean, can you tell us more about that? And she really had nothing to say because it's not something she thought through. She was really, I think she just became a mirror suddenly of what she thought her party's base wanted to hear in that moment. And that's, of course, not at all a recipe for success in a campaign. But it's almost like the timing has collided with, you know, what actually is an authentic expression of Kamala Harris's worldview. And that combination, I think voters will see soon on the trail, is a really powerful one.
Okay, so forgive me for this. I'm going to ask you to look into a little crystal ball, maybe not the future, but more like reinvent kind of the past year and a half. When Biden initially ran, he talked about being a bridge. We've heard that. And so in our minds, our thoughts were when the midterm elections were to come, not midterm election, but the next presidential election was to come around, that there would be a different candidate up for president. So for our sakes, Vice President Harris would be kind of the presumptive, a presumptive candidate at that time. I want you to tell me, like, if she were to have run from the beginning of this presidential cycle, do you feel like it all would have aligned in the same way? Or is it that it's this time with Biden having taken the time he needed to realize he needed to step down where she finds the most, where there's like really crunched 3 or 4 months before the election is really where she's going to, this is the time? Or could it have been also that year and a half where we could have had a fuller process?
I think that's a great question. And, you know, two things come to mind. One, as you, I think, astutely pointed out, a lot of the excitement and enthusiasm around Kamala Harris right now, you know, just sort of the $100+ million she's already raised in a mere 24 plus hours, I think you're right, is a lot to do with the fact that voters in the past 3 weeks have been desperate for a new Democratic nominee. Not even specifically who it should be, but just somebody different. And in that chaos, Kamala Harris emerges. And I think you can't overstate sort of the value of relief that has washed over the party. And that's contributing to just sort of this immediate excitement about her. At the same time, I do feel strongly that had Joe Biden sort of gone out maybe, like a year ago said, I'm ready to pass the campaign baton to Kamala Harris. I'm endorsing her as the Democratic nominee. I want her to pursue this case. I think she would have had a lot more time to show the American people that she is actually up to the job of commander in chief. I think she would have had a lot more time to sort of, and Biden as well, really, to showcase to Americans that she is prepared, because I think that's the major question Americans have right now. They don't know much about her. They don't know much about her record as vice president. So is she somebody that we can trust in the Oval Office? I think had the handoff essentially been something that was more planned for, premeditated, strategic, we would have had months at this point of her and Joe Biden explicitly making that case. So even though you do have the excitement right now, just overwhelming in a way that perhaps you wouldn't if it were a longer time ago, you know, once this sort of honeymoon dies down, those really tough questions are going to come about, and her success is going to depend on her ability in a really short period of time to sell Americans on a narrative of her vice presidency that maybe they haven't, you know, been given to this point.
She also would have had to face a larger slate of competitors, too, if she were to have been in that race, I imagine, back then as well. There'd have been more candidates who would have been vying for the nomination themselves, no?
Absolutely. And, you know, what's so interesting, too, is that even a year ago, you had leaders of the party like Nancy Pelosi, congressmen like Jamie Raskin, who would go on air and wouldn't even commit to saying they thought that Kamala Harris was the best choice for the vice presidential nominee for a Biden second term. So to me, it's been a lot of whiplash, honestly, seeing a lot of Democratic leadership go from that. You don't even want to go on record saying you think she should be the running mate again, to suddenly, yes, we're all in behind her for the presidency.
That would have been an interesting dynamic to see. Again, well, we did see a little bit in 2019 to 2020, but to see what it would have been like for her specifically to have those debates and have to have go toe to toe with other potential candidates, and how she would have found her footing in that way, on top of what we've already discussed in her diplomacy and all the other works. There's a portion of your article that I thought was really interesting where she talks, she invites you to her residence, right? And she's showing you the art in her home. Mm-hmm. Can you just talk about what happened there and what she described and what you found interesting about that moment?
Yeah, sure. So this was right when I got into the residence. So Kamala Harris, like past vice presidents to Walter Mondale, who was the first to live in that residence on the Naval Observatory, have redecorated it sort of to their liking. So as you can imagine, when Kamala Harris came in, Vice President Mike Pence's style wasn't entirely in keeping with her own aesthetic.
Right.
So she immediately brought a new designer in, the first Black female designer to work on the interior of the vice president's residence. And, you know, really kind of had it had something more in keeping with her California aesthetic. And so she wants to show me sort of the punch colored wallpaper, what she says is going to redefine what power looks like. But I thought what was most interesting in that tour was she took me, basically she wanted to tell me a bit about the art that she had chosen. And as we're going from, you know, painting to sculpture to mixed media, each piece she's describing in terms of the identity of the artist, him or herself. So she'll say, this is a Japanese American who did this piece. This is a gay American who did this piece. But at no point did she stop and say to me, but this is why the piece resonated with me. This is what I liked about the art itself. So I don't know. I just found that interesting that, you know, we sort of got into the identitarian characteristics of this piece, but that's how we were breezing through the tour, as opposed to her telling me what had actually moved her about the art piece itself. In question. Yeah.
To me, it struck me because it was like, this is clearly there's something that she understands this art does. Like there is a portrayal, I think, an embracing of the diversity that she brings to her office that she's acknowledging, but there's still almost like that same barrier that you talked about really leaning into like the internal elements of who she is. It always makes me ask the question, like who is Kamala Harris? Like, yes, she is she's the first female Black and South Asian vice president. She is now potentially going to be the first Black and vice president, Black and South Asian nominee for president. But who are you in all that? How does that inform you? That's still a question I still want answered, and it always fascinates me. But that art to me, I felt like was a way for her to say, yeah, you see this, this is what it represents, and this is how
exactly.
I represent my identity in this space, but not quite going deep enough, right?
I know, I'll just say it struck me as very performative and pretty shallow. And I think that art and how people connect with art is really a way to understand who they are as people, as you said. And she just did not take that opportunity. And I think that, you know, at a certain point, if that translates to how she runs this campaign, like continues to be sort of at the surface level, talking about, you know, the first that she represents,
right.
But not much more than that.
Right.
I don't know how far that campaign can penetrate in the American consciousness.
Yeah, I was thinking the same, especially because we don't yet know. And I'm curious to find out, as we've been talking about her finding her footing in policy and finding her footing debating other candidates and speaking with world leaders, whether that's also something she's going to find her space in. Like, will she find a way to embrace this identity that's beyond just the surface level? Was there any indication, I guess, just want to ask you, over the time you were following her, that she was, where she like opened up in that area? Or was it always kind of this is the identity, this is as far as I'm going to get you to understand how this or what this means to me?
I think, you know, what's interesting is I think she wants to get past that place. I just don't think she quite knows how, or rather before Monday, at least, I think she had just never settled into a place of knowing how to tell that story. I think she is somebody who has been really afflicted by what she thinks people want to hear, what she thinks will just sort of superficially excite people. I think her past as really kind of a more pragmatic and moderate Democrat is something that she just has not often wanted to lean into. But what I think she can forget is that oftentimes it's not sort of the marginal differences between what she might believe versus, you know, the most leftist activist. It's the fact that she's really authentic in her expression of it that I think is what ends up exciting voters in the end, or what they find more compelling, more than those marginal differences. But I think it's been hard for her to accept that. I go back to her risk aversion. you know, not ever wanting to say the wrong thing or get backlash. But based on her remarks on Monday and how she carried herself, again, that was Kamala Harris more authentically herself than at any point in the time that I've covered her. So I'll be interested to see if that continues.
Okay. Well, Elena Plott Calabro, thank you so much for joining me today on Created Equal. Really appreciate the conversation.
Thank you so much for having me. It was wonderful.
That'll do it for Created Equal. You can listen to recent episodes at WDET.org and make sure to subscribe to the podcast. Created Equal is produced by me and David Lyons, and our engineer is Nate Bender. Our program director is Adam Fox. Created Equal is a WDET production, a listener-supported service of Wayne State University.